It's very common. In fact, I would say it's usual for the font or baptistry to be located, as ours is, either actually in the doorway of the church or certainly near it. This is the case in many, or perhaps even most, Anglican churches and those of related traditions. Sometimes there's a desire to locate the font at the front of the church, because then the gathered congregation can see the proceedings more easily when someone is baptized. That is certainly more convenient for everyone, but in my view, there should not be much that is convenient about baptism. As it did for Jesus, baptism should interrupt what is convenient or normal or usual and wake us up to something extraordinary, the presence of God's kingdom in our midst. Of course, unlike this one, many churches are cross-shaped or cruciform. This one isn't. We don't have transepts. You know, those things that go across, which very often include an outside door. So it's sometimes possible to locate the font both at the front and near a door, because there's a door often in the transept. But to me, it's really quite important that the font be located at or near the main entrance, the door through which the majority will enter the church most of the time. And that is because baptism is the beginning. It's where we start our journey to God. So to say that in the symbolic language of our sacred space and the architectural language, by locating the rite of baptism near the entrance, and to give us that visible reminder, that physical reminder, each and every time we enter the church, making it impossible to enter the church without being reminded that we are baptized. We are baptized into the body of Christ, making each new entry into the church an opportunity to begin that journey to God again. That's really important to me as a spiritual practice, and I commend that practice to everyone. Many of us like to make that reminder and that new beginning very vivid for ourselves, as we saw with the kids, by dipping our fingers into the font, into the blessed water, and making the sign of the cross. And for me, this is powerful. It makes God's presence palpable, touchable. We feel the water on our skin. It's wet. It's cool. Water is the means of life, and touching the blessed water in the font reminds us in our whole being, beyond just our intellects, that the maker of water, the giver of life, is here, is part of our lives, that we've come here specifically to meet her in the company of these wonderful friends. If you've never tried it, I encourage you to touch the water of baptism in the font when you enter and when you leave, and then make the sign of the cross for yourself. It's a vivid, simple, and beautiful way to remind yourself that at your baptism, you were signed with the sign of the cross, marking you as Christ's own forever. In a way, though, there's a downside to locating the font by the door. A downside to having a priest like me stand up saying it's the beginning of our journey to God and stuff like that. Because in an institution like this, and people often think of us as an institution, if we do that, people start thinking, well, it's an administrative thing. We fall into thinking, well, baptism is a hoop to jump through to become a member or whatever. And yes, please forget that. There is nothing administrative about baptism. It's not a hoop. It is a deep, deep awakening to a truth about ourselves that we can only hear from God. A truth about ourselves and a truth about everyone else. That might be the most important part. That we can only hear from God. And that's why we do baptism. To have that awakening. It's the same awakening that Jesus had. as he came up out of the water and heard the voice of God speaking to him. It says that the heavens opened and the voice of God spoke to him, saying the real truth about who he was. In many ways, this journey to God in baptism is the longest journey any of us ever take. There are many steps to it. It continues throughout our lives and beyond. I've said that baptism is the beginning, and it is. But I'm equally sure that for most of us who persevere on the journey, there are many beginnings. For example, I myself was baptized on September the 8th, 1963, a Sunday, at St. Luke's Anglican Church at the corner of Cedar Hill Crossroad and Cedar Hill Road in Victoria, B.C. Have you been there or something?
I went to school like a block away from
you. Oh, yeah. Excellent. So you know all about my place of baptism then. I was 5 months old. And I was, quite advanced for 5 months old, but I wasn't capable of much in the way of conscious thought at the time. But that date, September 8th, 1963, has become increasingly important to me. I never knew the date, actually, until I was being ordained in the late 90s, and I had to look it up to complete the forms, speaking of administrative hoops, etc. But I notice how grateful I've become for that piece of information. Once I knew the date, I never forgot it. I've never had to look it up again or remind myself of it. I haven't written it down anywhere except on those forms which I sent off. It's always present to me in recall, and I get a certain feeling about it, I notice, as though I've come to have the spiritual awakening of the conscious spiritual awakening of my baptism in reverse or retrospectively or something. Or perhaps that really is the power of baptism, that God works through that mystery, through that sacrament, through the prayers and faithfulness of the community in ways that go beyond the individual. There's a mystery there. That baptism in the year of my birth was the sacramental beginning of my journey to God. I've had many other beginnings, though, some of them quite recent. I've spoken to many of you about something that happened for me during my 8-day silent retreat in a Jesuit monastery in Guelph, Ontario, in August of 2018, my first one. I've got another one coming up, but that was my first one. And when I was there, my spiritual director, Bernie Carroll, SJ, challenged me in a gentle, loving, and also quite firm way. In a sense, I'd say he confronted me about whether I really felt loved by God. And the truth was, I sort of did. And of course, I understood intellectually that everyone is loved by God. I believed it. I believed it even of some of you. But did I experience myself as loved by God? That's what Bernie was asking me. Did I experience that myself as loved by God, as an immediate feeling, knowing experience, like we would if a human being stood in front of us and confronted us with their deep love for us with hugs and eye contact and love and whatever. In truth, the answer is no. I had not experienced God's love in that vivid way as an ongoing experience, even though I had been ordained for 18 years by that time. And for 18 years, my main job had been to have each and every one of you know that you are deeply, utterly loved by God yourself, as you are. Frankly, I was scared by Brother Bernie making me confront that truth. I honestly avoided it on the first day. I found every imaginable thing to do during that whole 24 hours of silence. other than talk to God about whether and how God loves me and how I can experience that. And I'm sure you can understand. I mean, what if we had that conversation and God's answer was like, So, yeah, I coasted on that one, assuming that at the end of 24 uncomfortable hours of monastic silence, Bernie would, you know, cut me some slack and give me a different exercise to contemplate. But no, he instantly smelled a rat and made it clear we were going to stay with this one till we got somewhere. So I had a second 24-hour period of complete silence to look forward to, or not. And if you haven't been in monastic silence for an extended period, you're not allowed to talk with anyone. You're not allowed to make eye contact with anyone. You're not allowed to read. Complete silence. There's nothing to do while your food is taken care of. Complete silence for 24 hours of day and night. Yeah, so here I am in a second one. And this time, I stayed in. I didn't turn away or coast or distract myself. It took that entire day of stillness. I actually sat in one place, outside, in an Adirondack chair painted blue, overlooking a huge farm field and forest. And when I sat down there, the sun was high in the sky. And I don't know if you have ever sat there and watched the sun go from there, you know, to there. Like, being able to perceive the sun move is a... You know, it's a lot of waiting. And it was high in the sky, and it went lower and lower and lower and lower and lower. And eventually it got to the horizon, then into deepening darkness. It went down, beautiful sunset, it went down, got dark, and I'm staying there, staying with this question, asking God for this experience of being loved by him. Eventually, it got completely dark. And I was still sitting there, waiting for God's love. Eventually, it got so dark, I guess, that a skunk suddenly jumped out of the bushes next to me. And I mean, it was like where the piano is. A skunk jumped out of the bushes next to me and chased me away. So I eluded the skunk, I'm happy to say, because I was quite concerned about doing that. And I went and sat in the church in the dark. And I fixed my gaze on the presence lamp, just like that red lamp hanging there over the high altar. That's called the presence lamp. And it burns to indicate the presence of the body and blood of Christ in the reserved sacrament, the blessed wafers and wine, which are kept in the ombre. See, there's that thing, it looks like a cupboard or a box on the wall above the credence table there. That's called the ombre, and there's the body and blood is kept in there, the wafers and wine, the blessed wafers and wine. It's next to the altar at all times, and it's the deep symbol of Christ's presence in this church. It burns always, except for a brief period between the stripping of the altar on Maundy Thursday and the celebration of the Eucharist on Holy Saturday at the Easter Vigil. It's always, always burning, a symbol of the perpetual presence of Christ. And I sat and I stared at that lamp in the dark for hours, waiting, watching, listening, expecting that if anything happened at all, it would be like, I don't know, the heavens opening and an outpouring of God's loving spirit to have me know in a new way that I am loved. But something completely different happened. After hours of this, when my mind had wandered, and frankly, I had lost it, I suddenly sat upright in my chair and talked back to the voice in my head. And here's what I said. These are the exact words. I said, "You can't tell me I'm not loved. You can't tell me I'm not loved. I'm me." And that was it. It. I had been loved all along, as you are. And I had known it, felt it. But somewhere along the line, I picked up a voice in my head, which I realize now was not my own voice, and definitely not God's voice. And that voice cast doubt in my mind about whether I really could be loved by God or, frankly, by anyone else. And that voice always spoke to me in the second person. I remember it always called me you. But that voice is gone now. It never came back, even for an instant, after that night. Chased away by skunks, I guess. And now I can absolutely say, with the deepest knowing I've ever known, you are loved. 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 That is what baptism is. You are loved. That is what baptism is. That is what Jesus heard at his baptism by John the Baptist in the River Jordan 21 centuries ago. Join him in knowing it about yourself. It is the beginning place of your whole life, of everything we can hope to accomplish in human life. You are loved. If you've got a voice in your head that says awful things to you, talk back to it. Find a skunk to chase it away. Go on a silent retreat. Do whatever it takes to push back against those awful lies, because you are loved. In you, God is well pleased.